Welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. I'm Susan Wall, and I'm reading August Gale by Maine author Barbara Walsh, copyright 2012 by Barbara Walsh, and published by GPP in Guilford, Connecticut. Today we're beginning episode 15 on page 204 of this 247-page book. In episode 14, despite additional confirmation that the body was indeed Tom Reed's, no one dared challenge Father McGettigan, who buried the man in Patty Walsh's grave. But the day after the funeral, Lillian's head cleared, and she knew she had to insist the body be exhumed and examined for a different scar, one Tom bore on his back. And the priest complied. When the scar was exposed, Father McGettigan ordered Reed's sons to carry their father's body to their family's plot. And Billy Mitchell gloated over his new storytelling opportunity. Now, episode 15. Left alone to place the last shovelful of dirt on his father's grave, Billy Reed whispered a prayer for his da and his family. How, Reed wondered, do I explain this to Ma? Later in her kitchen, Jessie Reed scolded her son. 'Tis a shameful thing, you at the wake and not knowing your own father. Billy Reed dug the toe of his worn shoe into the kitchen floor, unable to meet his mother's angry eyes. Throughout Marystown and the rural outports beyond, word of the mismatched bodies traveled. On fish wharves, in backyard gardens, at kitchen tables, and in huddled groups of schoolchildren, the stories were swapped. The details savored. You should have seen McGettigan's face after he slashed the coat off Tom Reed's back. Shock and angry he was. Slumped into his parlor chair, the priest sipped from a tall glass of rum. McGettigan gazed at the mid-morning sun sparkling on the bay. His thoughts drifted back to just a week past, before the gale had torn apart this small outport and his reputation. McGettigan knew there would be no forgetting this day. A Catholic priest digging up a corpse and swapping bodies from one grave to another. The sacrilege would be remembered for generations. He reached for the decanter of rum, hoping to dull the memory of Billy Mitchell's face gloating at the graveside. The priest had no doubt Mitchell would make his way from one kitchen table to another, drinking cold beer and greedily consuming platters of beef as he offered the details again and again. There would be no getting over this, the priest thought. No getting over any of it. Chapter 28. Graveyards and Redemption, Marystown, June 2003. Alan Brenton leads us through the graveyard. He walks past dozens of whitewashed, century-old markers. It's over here, Alan says. My father, sister, and I follow him toward the center of the Sacred Heart Cemetery, where two dark granite markers rise from the grass. We fall quiet, awed to be standing before Patty Walsh's gravestone. The words etched in the polished granite read, Captain William Patrick, lost at sea, 1887 to 1935. Ever remembered, ever loved. Next to Patty's stone stands another similar marker, in loving memory of James, Jerome, and Francis. Lost at sea, August 25th, 1935. Rest in peace. Mary Bernice, the baby for whom James's schooner was named, is also remembered on the stone with her name, and August 20th, 1920, death date. A third marker, rounded and whitewashed, bears the name of Lillian and Patty's baby, Cornelius, the infant who died December 30th, 1917, after a few short months of life. An etching of a small lamb and a cross cover the top of the stone, and the epitaph reads, There was a little flower that blossomed but to die, transplanted now in heaven to bloom with God on high. Nearby there are several other grave markers for young children and babies, victims of a rural outport ravaged by poverty and disease in the early 1900s. A cluster of stones mark the loss of Patty's younger brother Philip, who fathered 17 children and buried 6 of them. One stone records 4 of the children's deaths. In loving memory of the darling child Adrian Walsh, died November 1933, aged 13 years. Also Alan Walsh, aged 3 months, Edward Walsh, aged 5 months, Thomas, aged 2 months. On this June afternoon, Alan, my father, sister, and I are the only visitors to the cemetery. Scores of small wooden crosses mark the flat, barren terrain, where tufts of grass struggle to grow. The bogs and scrub brush that once overran the graveyard are long gone. So, too, are the woods where young boys once hid to watch the spectacle of Tom Reed's body being pulled from the grave. In my mind, I see a crowd of men gathered on this patch of dirt 68 years ago. Father McGettigan stands among them. I imagine the priest's anger as the fishermen lift the coffin from the ground, and the scar is revealed on Tom Reed's back. As the priest feared, the story of the mismatched bodies has lived on for nearly 7 decades. Almost everyone we meet knows the tale. "Did ye hear," they ask us, "the story about Tom Reed being waked and buried as Paddy?" The peculiar wake and the exhumation, the only one to ever occur in Marystown, have become lore, legend, in this small town. "Bit strange that Paddy's name is on the gravestone, but his body isn't there, eh?" Alan asks. Though the names of Paddy and his 3 sons are listed on the stone, only one body lies beneath the earth, the remains of 12-year-old Frankie. Like thousands of other fishermen, Paddy Walsh's body rests in the sea. I envision the skipper's final moments, the waves swamping his dory, the water filling his lungs. Before his last breath, did he cry out for help, seek redemption for his 3 sons and himself? Or did he die rebuffing God, like his younger brother Ambrose would decades later? During his final days in a hospital bed, my grandfather shunned the Catholic priest who offered him last rites. "I haven't believed in God my whole life," Ambrose told the minister, "and I'm not about to give in now." My grandfather did not want or receive the priest's absolution, yet I know he harbored remorse for his transgressions. His guilt weighed heavily on his conscience on March 28, 1989, the day of my Nana's funeral. That morning, Alan Brenton's first wife, Sybil Turpin, had flown to California to visit Ambrose and his wife, Arlene. Ambrose had just learned of my Nana's death through a family friend who lived in California. While Arlene went to work, Sybil and Ambrose sat at the kitchen table. Staring blankly at the wall, Ambrose fell unnaturally quiet. "He was never really what you call happy," Sybil recalled. "But on the day your grandmother died, there was a heavy sadness about him. I think his life was flashing before his eyes then, the choices he'd made. He never talked about leaving his first family, but it was always there, his regrets about what he had done." From his wallet, Ambrose pulled the photographs that he had long kept hidden in his billfold. He handed Sybil 2 pictures, one of a toddler, and the other a boy of 11. "These are my sons, Ronnie and Billy," he told Sybil. "Patricia did a good job raising them. They turned out to be better men without me." "That's a hard thing to admit when you're in your 80s and your life is nearly done," Sybil thought. Ambrose had never before talked to her about his sons or his first wife, but on this afternoon his thoughts focused on the past. He spoke about his son Ronnie's visits to the ship rigging loft in Brooklyn, and he talked about how Patricia often wrote him letters, sending him updates about the boys, the college degrees they had attained, the women they had married, and the children they had raised. Ambrose also had something else he wanted to share. He insisted Sybil read a story about the shy blonde-haired girl he fell in love with on Staten Island. He retrieved the story from his bedroom closet, explaining, "This is about Patricia. It was written by my granddaughter, the reporter." Titled Nana, the high school essay detailed how my grandmother doted on my 5 sisters and me, spoiling us with homemade chocolate fudge, strawberry shortcake, and Sunday dinners, how she taught us penny poker and pig Latin, told us spooky stories, and took us for walks in the woods, where mounds of dirt transformed into castles, tree branches into witches' fingers. Ambrose treasured that story, he really did, Sybil explained to me years later during our trip to Newfoundland. Why did he treasure it, I wondered. Did it make him happy to know that Patricia, my Nana, had eventually found happiness? That she was adored by her grandchildren? Did the story ease some of his guilt? Or did it remind him of the young woman who showed him kindness soon after he immigrated to the Boston States? Not long after Sybil left California and flew back to Newfoundland, Ambrose discovered that the ache in his back signaled more than old age. He had end-stage colon cancer. Over the next several months, the pain and disease consumed him. He died a little more than a year after my Nana's death. I think of my grandfather as I study Paddy's gravestone and the large, bold Walsh surname engraved on the granite marker. 2 decades earlier, Ambrose stood on this same plot of dirt. He made his own pilgrimages to Paddy's grave whenever he returned to Marystown. Alone, he visited the cemetery, sharing a silent conversation with his hero, the brother whom he idolized and sought to emulate. Did he talk to Paddy about his poor choices, his regrets? Did he wish he had been more like Paddy, a loyal husband, a faithful father? Alan jars me from my thoughts, asking if we would like our pictures taken, a souvenir of this much-talked-about sight. My father, Joni, and I gather in between the polished stones. Fittingly, my dad is dressed in his navy cap and sweatshirt, a salute to his Uncle Paddy and his love of the sea. As Alan focuses the camera on us, my father instinctively wraps his arms around Joni and me. We smile, captured on film at our ancestors' burial site, photos that we will later pass around to our own family, furthering the Marystown lore, explaining, "This is where Tom Reed's body was dug up from Paddy's grave." Handing the camera back to me, Alan offers to show my father the grave of his mother, Donalda. As they walk away, I linger behind to touch the stones and say a prayer for Paddy and his deceased children. Though his name is not listed, his grave not here, I also utter a prayer for my grandfather. "I hope you found peace before you died." No one is good when they run off on their children, Sybil has told me, trying to explain my grandfather's character. But down deep, Ambrose was a good man. I breathe in the scent of the sea, the salty breeze of my grandfather's birthplace. Here, in the stillness of the cemetery, I want to believe that Ambrose asked for redemption before his death, that he whispered, "I'm sorry." Even if my Nana, Dad, and Uncle never heard those words, I want to believe my grandfather sought their forgiveness. Chapter 29. The Storm Still Lingers, Marystown, 1935. A pall, a darkness in spirit and hope, settled over Marystown like a black thunderhead. On footpaths, in classrooms, and in meadows, the fatherless children passed one another and nodded, the tears inevitably tarnishing their cheeks. No words did they share. Each understood the loss that pressed like a stone on their hearts from morn till night. Dressed in black from head to toe, their dyed stockings, aprons, and dresses cloaking them in grief, the August Gale widows carried their own burdens. The women worked from dawn to dusk. They raked hay until their hands blistered, washed and salted the cod until their fingers numbed with cold. They pulled beets, potatoes, and carrots from the ground and stored the vegetables in their cellars, hoping it could carry them through the cold months ahead. In between their work and worry, the widows often stared at the bay and sobbed. They spoke to the water as if it would somehow talk back to them, render the secrets of where their husbands' bodies lay hidden. 5 months pregnant, with a 2-year-old daughter and a 5-year-old son, Mary Hanrahan cried herself to sleep and lingered by the bay where her husband Charles had departed on the Annie Anita. "I wish we could find your dad," she often told her children. "I miss him, the poor soul." Like the other widows, Mary received $9.50 each month from the Marine Disaster Fund. With the 31 cents a day, she provided what she could for her son and daughter. Still, dinner was often nothing more than a crust of bread and a spoonful of molasses, a meal that did not satisfy, and often ended with tears and protests from her children. "We're hungry, Mother." "My dears," she tried to explain, "we just got to put up with what we got. I've no more to give us." From the Presbytery meadow across the water, Father McGettigan watched the widows stand by the shore's edge, gazing at the bay as if they expected the sails of their husbands' vessels to appear. Day after day, the priest crossed the inlet in his skiff to visit the mothers and check on their children, who grew paler with each passing week. The sight of their gaunt faces sent shivers down his collar. "The young will not survive the winter. Their bones poke through their thin clothing like sticks." As the autumn days grew shorter, the widows grew angrier over their misfortune. They wanted explanations for the August gale, reasons why the Lord swept their men to death in the cold, dark sea. "Why, father?" the widows asked. "Why did God take our husbands?" McGettigan shook his head and folded his hands in prayer. Surely the Lord had his reasons for their fate, but even the priest wrestled with the magnitude of Marystown's loss, and he feared that more sorrow would befall the small outport and its young. The doctor and constable shared McGettigan's concern. Before the winter snows fell and the bay turned to ice, the law officer knocked on the doors of the August Gale widows. Unwilling to hand over their sons and daughters, mothers pointed to pots of water boiling on cook stoves, a ruse that failed to satisfy the constable, who understood there was nothing to boil, nothing to cook. Her 3-month-old baby on her hip, Alice Brinton confronted the officer's solemn face as he stood in her kitchen. The past few weeks had tested the young woman, but she was not ready to give up her daughters. "Pack up your children," the constable told her. "I'll take them to the orphanage." Alice reached for her daughter's hands. She could barely stand from the exhaustion and grief. Still, she would be damned if she would parcel her children off like packages. "If they're going to starve," she told the officer, "then they'll starve at home." Other widows with larger families and 6 or 7 children to feed had no choice but to send 1 or 2 of their offspring away to the orphanages in St. John's. Tom Reed's wife, Jessie, reluctantly hugged her 9-year-old daughter Teresa goodbye. "My dear girl, we will see ye soon," her mother promised. Jessie also lost another child, her son, Bill Reed, to the law. The boy was arrested by the Rangers, the government police, for stealing a sack of flour to help feed his family. Angry over the injustice, Jessie pelted the officer's boat with wood and rocks as they hauled her son away to serve his time. Several other fishermen's wives grew so desperate they scattered their children in neighboring villages among families who could spare a bit of food and a bed. And though she could afford to provide for her 4 surviving children, Lillian Walsh's tattered nerves and grief left her in a daze. She could not console nor control her 7-year-old daughter, little Lillian. Tormented by her own heartache, the child thrashed on the floor, screaming for her father. "She'll be better off in the orphanage," Father McGettigan advised. "The sisters will look after her there and provide the girl with a good education." The spirited young girl, who had often fished with her father and had pleaded to sail with him on his August journey, found herself in the red-bricked Belvedere Orphanage of St. John's. Supervised and taught by the stern and formidable Sisters of Mercy, Lillian took comfort in the familiar face of Teresa Reed, who had also been placed there. Just as her father had depended on his second hand, Tom Reed, at sea, Lillian now sought Reed's daughter for kinship and memories of home. As the fall winds chilled the night air, Father McGettigan continued to visit and check on the widows. The vacant and worn look in their eyes alarmed the priest. Lucy Walsh particularly concerned McGettigan. She could barely hold her baby as she sat in her rocking chair, trembling. The young woman's mind was locked on the past, the days before her husband James set sail on the Mary Bernice. She had little interest in caressing or feeding her blue-eyed infant born the night of the gale. The child reminded her of death. "She has a horrible case of nerves," McGettigan told Lucy's mother, Selina Galton. "Perhaps it's best for her to go away." Selina nodded. A midwife for many years, she knew her daughter might never recover from the tragedy. Before the spring snows thawed, Lucy would be gone, leaving Marystown and her baby, Jamie, behind. In the home on the hill, Lillian concealed herself behind closed drapes and shades. At night, every lamp blazed, warding off the shadows and darkness. Lillian dared not sleep for fear of the images that settled in her dreams, visions of her sons screaming, "Mother!" as the monstrous waves battered their vessels and pulled them beneath the malevolent sea. "My babies, my poor babies, why did I let them go? Why?" For hours she stared at photographs of her sons and Patty, talking to them as if they were seated on the settee next to her. One by one she held the pictures to her eyes, studying the details, the moments of their lives frozen in the black and white images. Her fingers outlined the edge of Jerome's rounded face in a photograph taken in the priest's meadow during a Lady Day garden party. Dressed in a white shirt, tie, and the new brown breeches she had sewn for him, her boy grinned into the camera. 10 at the time, his hands stuck in his pockets, he balanced himself on a post, proud and confident. "Ye were always so sure of yourself, Jerome, so full of spirit like your da." Lillian picked up another picture of Frankie and Jerome. The two of them sat shoulder to shoulder in their uncle's rowboat. Caps on their small heads, they smiled, secure in the vessel that was safely moored on shore. "Ye were only 5 and 7 then, good little brothers, always at each other's side, looking out for one another. Sleep well, boys. Take care of each other now until your mother can hold ye close again." Turning to a photograph of Paddy, little Lillian, and Paddy Jr., Lillian remembered the chilly Sunday it was taken. She had insisted they take a picture on that afternoon in 1934. The three of them posed on the side of the house. Bundled like a doll in his snowsuit, Paddy Jr. gazed downward, mesmerized by something in the grass. Outfitted in a dress and her Sunday coat and shoes, Lillian pressed close to her father's side. Her small hand wrapped around one of her father's large fingers. Dressed in a cap, suit coat, and tie, Paddy stared straight into the camera, his eyes defiant, a surly smile on his lips. "Ye were afraid of nothing, Paddy, fearless of God and the sea, always believing ye'd return. But now little Lillian has no hand to hold, no father to take her fishing, and Paddy Jr. no dad to look up to. How will we get on without ye, Paddy?" Her son James gazed at Lillian from the last photograph. Leather jackboots rose to his knees. The woolen sailor's jacket his mother had sewn covered his broad shoulders. His lips pressed together, he shared his father's stern, serious look. "Oh, me son, you were ready to captain, ready to be a father. Ye would have done a fine job of both, dear boy, a fine job. Your new baby has your eyes, son. She'll be forever wanting to know ye, forever missing ye, like your mother. May the angels watch over ye, son." From the kitchen, Alice Brinton listened to Lillian's ramblings. If she hadn't known better, Alice would have thought James, Jerome, Frankie, and Paddy kept their mother company in the parlor. But the young maid understood how grief could change a woman, turn her daft with sorrow and heartache. Since Alice had lost her husband, John, off the Annie Anita, she had begun talking to her dead husband herself. "Are ye there, John? Can ye hear me? Is your spirit settled? Are ye at peace, my poor soul? We miss ye, John. Your daughters pray for ye every night. They love their da." Although Alice kept vigil for her husband, she glimpsed no sign of him, heard no whispers from his phantom lips. Still, she knew such things could happen. She had witnessed plenty of odd occurrences at Captain Paddy's home since the skipper's death. One evening, as she finished the ironing, she heard stomping on the stairs. Alice took the lamp into the hall and discovered a single brown shoe on the step. "Aye, that's Skipper Paddy's shoe. He always told Lillian if there was a way for him to come back, he'd find it. Dear blessed Mother of God, the captain had kept his word. No wonder Miss Lil was afraid of the night." "Go on now, Mr. Paddy. Settle down," Alice whispered in the dark. Another curious event startled Alice on a Sunday morning. She and the second maid were cooking dinner while Miss Lillian and her children had gone to church. The two women nearly jumped from their shoes at a loud crash in the dining room. "Must be the cat knocking the dishes from the table," Alice thought. Searching for the wreckage, she found nothing out of order. The plates, silverware, and glasses remained in place, and there was no sign of cats or any earthly evidence for the noise. "Jesus, something has the skipper out of sorts today," Alice reckoned, remembering Paddy's rage as he pounded the tea kettle spout, angry over his late dinner. If she wasn't so desperate for the extra money and the second-hand clothes that Miss Lil offered, Alice would have steered clear of the captain's quarters for good. "Don't be passing Paddy's house after dark," she warned her children. Throughout the winter, into the spring and summer, the shades and drapes remained drawn on the house on the hill, and the lights continued to blaze from dusk to dawn. Inside, Lillian sat beneath the lamplight, shrouded in black, holding the photographs of her three sons and husband, her voice filling the parlor with hushed murmurs and memories. Chapter 30, August Thunder and Ambrose's Daughters, New Hampshire, August 2003. The young man knocked on the door. Ambrose did not recognize the surprise visitor, his second-born son, William Patrick Walsh, the child he had named after his beloved brother Paddy. Bill Walsh eyed the man he believed to be his father. He had seen pictures of him, but still he was not sure. "Are you Ambrose Walsh?" he asked. Ambrose nodded. "I'm your son, Billy." It was 1972, and my uncle had just completed his master's degree in social work. A few years earlier, Ambrose had surprised him with a phone call, wanting to talk. My uncle was excited about this unexpected connection with his dad. "Maybe he wants to reconcile with Ma, with us." Unlike my father, my uncle had no memories of Ambrose. He was a year and a half old when Ambrose had slipped out the door in Brooklyn, and just a few years older when his dad abandoned his family again in San Francisco. My father was not excited about hearing from Ambrose after 3 decades of silence, but my uncle thought, "I just want to see him. I want to see my dad's face." When he arrived at Ambrose's California home without warning, my uncle did not consider the repercussions of his visit. Unflustered by his son's sudden appearance, Ambrose invited my uncle into the living room. As the two of them talked, Ambrose's daughters returned home. 12 at the time, Donnie asked her mother, "Who is that man?" "He's your brother," Arlene said, pulling Donnie into the kitchen. "My brother?" Donnie asked. She had 4 older brothers, but no one had ever told her about this mysterious sibling. "What are you talking about?" Ambrose's eldest daughter, Kathy, glimpsed the man talking to her father. "He has to be related to us. He looks just like my brother, Jim." For years, Kathy had wondered about Ambrose's other family after discovering 2 paintings in her father's closet. The watercolors depicted young boys with curly light brown hair. "Who are they?" she had asked her dad. Ambrose shook his head, refusing to answer. "Who are they?" she persisted. "They're my sons from my first family," Ambrose said quietly, refusing to say anything more. Now, a decade later, Kathy stared at the stranger in her father's home. "That's got to be my brother." For most of her childhood, Kathy had dreamed about her mysterious brothers. "I wonder what their lives are like." After my uncle's impromptu visit, Donnie also began to consider her secret siblings and her connection to them. "Someday I want to meet them. I want to know them. They're my family." The August sky is dark, and storm clouds threaten as the plane touches down at the New Hampshire airport. After the sudden connection through our August gale research and multiple phone and email conversations with my father, Kathy and Donnie fly 3,000 miles east to meet the brothers they have long wondered about. They have no trouble recognizing my father at the airport terminal. He walks and carries himself like their brother Jim. Kathy's eyes tear up. "After so many years, I can't believe we're finally meeting our brother." As my father helps them carry their suitcases, Kathy and Donnie stare at his hands. They are identical to Ambrose's. Over the next few days, they will watch my father wave his palms in the air as he talks, place his fingers to his forehead as he thinks. "He's so much like Dad. His mannerisms are identical," Donnie whispers to her sister. "How," Kathy and Donnie will later ask themselves, "can he mirror Dad's characteristics so much when he was only with him for a short time?" Oddly, none of their other 4 brothers share Ambrose's traits. We've reached the end of episode 15 of August Gale by Barbara Walsh. I'm Susan Wall, and I thank you for listening.